From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When he was 24 years old, Robert Sam Anson was full of anger about the Vietnam War and full of ambition as a reporter. He ended up covering the war for Time magazine and making news himself when he was captured by the Viet Cong. Robert Sam Anson tells his story on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we meet John Lasseter. He's an Oscar-winning animator who draws not with pen and paints, but with a computer. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward explains how producer Willie Mitchell saved Memphis soul music from extinction. And book critic John Leonard reviews a newly released collection of essays by the late travel writer Bruce Chatwin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The United States today condemned Israel's deportation of five Palestinians from the occupied territories. And in Qatar, Arab states voted to request an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council to investigate the expulsions. Israel expelled five Palestinians last Sunday, four of them to Lebanon, one to France. Also today, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the U.S. wants Israel to determine who killed a 14-year-old youth in the West Bank earlier this month. A report by a Scottish pathologist retained by the family shows that Amjad Jabril Tawil was killed by a single gunshot wound. Tawil was born in Denver but lived in the West Bank for the past 4 years. In Lebanon, Shiite Muslim leader Nabi Berri today called on the U.S. to help end Lebanon's civil war in order to solve the hostage crisis. Mike Theodoulou filed this report from Nicosia.
Nabi Berri said America had to go to the core of the Lebanese problem before the hostage issue could be solved. This, said the leader of the Syrian-backed Amal militia, was the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Until then, he said, there had been no kidnapping. Amal, a generally moderate Muslim movement, is not involved in hostage-taking, unlike its Shiite rival Hezbollah, which, despite many denials, is believed to front most of the kidnapped groups in Lebanon. Berri's statement follows many similar ones from Lebanese Muslim leaders, as well as from Iran and Syria, that the hostage crisis can only be solved in the context of an overall settlement to the Lebanese war, which has defied peace efforts for 14 years. Muslim leaders like Berri believe that a settlement can only be achieved when Israel withdraws from its self-declared security zone in southern Lebanon. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
The father of three reputed drug barons in Colombia appealed for the government to end its fierce war on drugs and negotiate a peace. Meanwhile, six more bombs exploded today in the cocaine trafficking center of Medellin. And in Washington, Justice Minister Monica DeGraaf repeated her government's refusal to negotiate with drug traffickers. President Bush met with drug policy advisors today to put the finishing touches on the administration's anti-drug strategy, scheduled to be unveiled next week. National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft assured reporters at the president's home in Kennebunkport that the administration thinks drug trafficking is a big problem.
So we think this is a very important issue. We all have a major stake in going after the drug cartels, and the Colombians are bravely standing up now to take them on, and we want to do everything we can to help.
Scowcroft said it's too early to comment on Colombia's request for another $19 million in aid on top of the $65 million that Bush has already approved. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 16 points to close at 2726.63. Declines led advances 9-7. This is NPR News. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says it has concluded that emissions from a northern Arizona power plant are to blame for the air pollution in the Grand Canyon. The agency says it will require action to be taken to preserve the canyon's environment. Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
Environmentalists have long been concerned that air pollution could one day obscure the view of the Grand Canyon, which last year attracted nearly 4 million visitors from across the world. Acting under a court order obtained by an environmental group, the EPA has formally cited the Navajo Generating Station in northern Arizona for contributing from 40% to 70% of the canyon's visible pollutants. The EPA said it was able to pinpoint the coal-burning power plant as a source of the haze by injecting a chemical into the plant's smokestacks. The chemical was later detected at a main visitor area on the canyon's northern rim. The EPA says it will announce by February what pollution control steps must be taken to reduce the plant's emissions. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
A Democratic congressional organization said today that after more than 6 months in office, President Bush has left an unprecedented number of top government positions unfilled. The Democratic study group said the failure to fill vacancies is creating possible problems for his own administration. The report is based on an analysis of 394 top government executive positions, requiring appointment by the president and confirmation by the Senate. The analysis shows four previous administrations made the appointments at the first 6 weeks at a pace four times as fast as that of the Bush administration. The International Monetary Fund has cut its estimates for U.S. and worldwide economic growth this year. The revision goes against the recent trend of improving economic expectations. In a draft of its annual report, the fund estimates the U.S. economy will grow 2.7%. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Robert Sam Anson was 24, Time magazine's youngest correspondent, when he first reported from Vietnam in 1969. He was opposed to the war, but the North Vietnamese, with whom he sympathized, captured him in Cambodia and held him as a prisoner of war for nearly a month. In his new book, War News, Anson reflects on what it was like to be a young, aggressive, reckless reporter covering the war in Indochina in the late 60s and early 70s. Anson is also the author of a biography of George McGovern, a portrait of Richard Nixon in the years following his resignation, a chronicle of Rolling Stone magazine and its changes in content and significance, and an investigation into the death of Edmund Perry, a young black man who was shot while attempting to rob a white plainclothes policeman in New York. Perry had just graduated from Exeter, a prestigious prep school. Robert Sam Anson now lives in Thailand. He told me why, as a young man, he was anxious to cover the war in Vietnam.
Well, I suppose a function of it was being 24 years old and not knowing any better. The larger reason was that I was a reporter and an ambitious one at that time. And Vietnam was the biggest, most interesting and dangerous story in the world. And frankly, I had been involved in the anti-war movement while I was in college in Vietnam. For those of us who grew up in the 60s, it was really one of the central facts of our life, and I wanted to see it firsthand.
As you point out many times in your book, Time had a pretty hawkish editorial policy at the time. You were opposed to the war. How did they send you to Vietnam?
They made the mistake of never asking me what I thought about the war. They assumed that anyone who worked for Time magazine would believe, as Time did, that it was the right war in the right place at the right time.
You were basically exiled to Laos and Cambodia after spending some time in Vietnam. What do you think got you exiled?
What got me exiled was an ongoing, endless argument in the bureau about how the war was going. There were three correspondents at the time. My bureau chief was a middle-of-the-road type who thought that we probably shouldn't have come to Vietnam, but now that we were there, we shouldn't leave, because if we did, a bloodbath would really come. The other correspondent, who's today at the Heritage Foundation, the right-wing think tank, thought that Vietnam was wonderful in a way of stopping communism, and I believe that the war in Vietnam was murderous and immoral, and we should never have been there. And now that we were there, we should get out, because all we were doing was killing a lot of people, both Vietnamese and Americans. And it finally, all these discussions and arguments hurt the work of the Bureau, and it was clear that someone had to go. And since I was the odd man out, I was elected as the one to be bounced. But fortunately, it worked out in the manner of Br'er Rabbit being tucked into the briar patch, because I was sent to Cambodia just before it became the biggest story in the world for a while.
You were in Cambodia just at the time when the Cambodians were setting up Vietnamese internment camps.
Actually, the government in Cambodia called them concentration camps, which in fact they were.
Would you explain why these were being set up?
Well, there were about 600,000 Vietnamese civilians living in Cambodia at that time. They had lived in Cambodia for generations. Most of them, as it happened, the overwhelming majority of them, in fact, were Catholics and bitterly anti-communist. There is a historical antipathy between the Cambodians and the Vietnamese. It's almost has a racial basis to it, and one means of whipping up popular support for the new regime, the new American-supported regime, it was decided, would be to use the Vietnamese resident in Cambodia as a target. And both propaganda, and then after a while, they started locking them away into concentration camps, and after that followed massacres on a large scale.
What was the first evidence you had, the first thing that you witnessed that made you realize that these internment camps, these concentration camps, are getting set up.
They made no secret about them. They were there was a large camp being formed right in Phnom Penh that everyone could see. The Cambodians did it out in the open because they wanted to intimidate people, and within 3 days after that, there was a first massacre that was about 40 miles away from Phnom Penh that all the press went down and found the bodies afterward. The explanation the Cambodians gave was that the Vietnamese had been caught in a crossfire between their forces and the Viet Cong. There was no way to prove it otherwise. Then another week followed, and suddenly there were 1,500 bodies of Vietnamese civilians in the river. There was no hiding it, but at the time, the press was not able to pin responsibility on the Cambodians for doing this.
Before,
that changed later.
There was one internment camp in Takeo that you would go to virtually every day to check as a way of basically letting the Cambodians know that they were being watched.
That's right.
That what they were doing, if they slaughtered people, it was not going to go unnoticed, unreported. But one day when you drove down, a massacre had already taken place. Would you describe what you saw?
There had been detained in that particular camp in Takeo about 250 men and boys down to the age of about 4 years old. I was going down there with another reporter every day because I'd become quite alarmed by what was happening to Vietnamese civilians, having seen thousands of bodies around the country. They seemed okay at first, and then one day we drove down there and could see no movement in this particular concentration camp. And as we got closer, heard this strange sound that was turned out to be the beating of the wings of thousands and thousands of flies. And what had happened was that the Cambodian army had come in overnight and machine gunned all the Vietnamese, and there were about 225 dead and about 25 still wounded, some of them very horribly, most of them children.
What were your instincts there about what to do, whether you should just report on this or try to rescue some of the survivors?
Frankly, my repertorial instincts went out the window. I was interested in getting the wounded children back to the hospital in Phnom Penh, about 60 miles away. And along with a fine reporter named Timothy Allman, that's what we did with the most seriously wounded of the children. And when we dropped this boy off at the hospital, I went and got the other reporters, some very big names in the American press corps then, and brought them back down to Takeo, thinking with their presence would deter the Cambodians from finishing off the rest of the wounded. After everyone finished doing their stories and putting away their camera gear and whatnot, I went to each of the reporters and said, would you take a child back with you to Phnom Penh? And with one exception, no one would. And the explanation given was that if you got involved saving the life of a wounded child, this was violating journalistic precepts. Frankly, that explanation didn't cut a lot of ice with me, and we ended up just piling all the kids who were wounded into one particular car that my friend and I drove back.
You were very young then. You're a veteran journalist now. If you were faced with the same situation, do you think you'd behave differently?
Not with that particular situation. I don't think I'd behave. I hope I wouldn't behave differently. I think, you know, we have different responsibilities, but I don't think you can put your humanity behind you by saying you're a detached, professional, objective observer because you're a journalist. I think we have larger responsibilities as human beings. I don't think you can forget those ethics just when you take out your notebook. I think that's a cop-out. And I certainly would behave differently in some regards to what I was doing in Cambodia, which was fairly reckless, but about that particular incident, not at all.
Well, after the massacre in Takeo, you wanted to stay overnight, kind of keep guard.
That's right.
So that the
some of the wounded who we hadn't been able to fit into the car wouldn't be butchered by the remaining Cambodians.
Describe what happened when the network reporter Bernie Kalb saw you there.
Well, it was a fairly dicey situation. Night was falling, and there were a couple of companies, Cambodian troops, camped out a couple of hundred yards away, and it was clear that after they finished their evening meal, they were going to come over and finish off the Cambodians and probably would catch me in the so-called crossfire. And Bernie Kalb was an extraordinary reporter, came back after dark and wrestled me actually into his car and took me away.
Were you ever sorry that he did? You think you were being a little crazy at that point?
At the time, I was terribly angry that he did. I was on the verge of hysteria about what was happening in Takeo, all that blood, and these were children who were not any older than my children. and I wasn't thinking very clearly, but I sometimes thought is not called for in situations. You just have to act. As it happened, it turned out all right. Overnight, the Cambodians did manage to survive, and that was the last time that Vietnamese civilians were massacred in Cambodia.
Now, you almost forgot to write the story up for Time.
Yeah.
You became so involved in it. When you did write it up, what did you say and how was it printed?
It was printed, I'm very happy to say, very accurately and fully. Time came down very, very hard on the Cambodian government for doing that, as did the United States government come down very hard on the Cambodians, and that did help put an end to the massacres.
My guest is journalist Robert Sam Anson. During the Vietnam War, he reported from Saigon and then from Cambodia, just as the war moved in there. He was taken prisoner of war and held for a month by North Vietnamese operating out of Cambodia. He's written a new book about his experiences reporting in Vietnam as a young correspondent. It's called War News. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Robert Sam Anson is my guest. His new book is called War News, A Young Reporter in Indochina. You were captured while you were in Cambodia. Who actually captured you and how?
It was North Vietnamese who captured me. Members specifically of a 9th Division, a very good division of the North Vietnamese infantry. What happened was that I was driving to a story one day late in the afternoon. I'd been told that a battle had occurred about 50 miles northwest of the capital of Phnom Penh. I had been there at that time about 6 months in Cambodia, and I thought I knew the country extremely well. A number of my colleagues had been captured or killed, and the longer I was there, the more invulnerable I felt, and so I wasn't thinking terribly clearly. I was coming very close to this particular town when I saw a number of soldiers dressed in green uniforms and wearing pith helmets and carrying AK-47s and shot in Ho Chi Minh sandals, and I was standing by the side of the road, and I waved to them automatically, and automatically they waved back. And about 100 yards later, it occurred to both of us that something unusual had happened, and they were, in fact, North Vietnamese regulars, and they concluded that I was, in fact, an American. I turned around and tried to drive back past them, and they gave me a burst of automatic weapons fire over the car, and I stopped.
Did being a journalist help at all?
It didn't at first. They believed that I was a pilot for some reason. Immediately after I was captured, I was taken out of the car and thrown into a hole and given a tool and told to dig deeper. And it was clear to me that I was digging my own grave. And this went on for 20 minutes or so. And then finally, one of the soldiers put the heel of his foot on my chest and then his rifle barrel to my forehead and locked and loaded on me. And he was about to shoot me in the head, and I remembered one particular word of Vietnamese, and it was the right word. The word was Hòa Bình, which in Vietnamese means peace. And he repeated the word Hòa Bình, and then he dragged me up out of the hole.
Well, that was really a very lucky break.
It was a near thing. I didn't so much say the word Hòa Bình as whimpered it. I was convinced that the end was really at hand and that my stupidity had at last caught up to me.
A great irony here is that you were the Time magazine's anti-war reporter, and here you were the captive of those who you sympathized with.
Yes. Yeah. And almost the victim of those I sympathized with, yes.
Did you try to communicate that to the North Vietnamese?
At first, I didn't think it was very smart to tell them that I was an American.
Wasn't that obvious?
It wasn't to them. They knew I was either a European or an American, and I understood a fair amount of Vietnamese, and they kept asking me whether I was an American, and I pretended that I didn't understand them. You have to realize that before I had been captured, 10 of my colleagues had been killed outright by the Vietnamese and Khmer Rouge, and another 26 had been captured. And of those 26, only 7 ever returned alive. So being a reporter in Cambodia was a fairly dangerous occupation in those days, and it certainly provided you with no immunity. So I've delayed as long as possible revealing my identity, and then finally a North Vietnamese officer came up to me in the middle of a monsoon storm, in fact, and offered me a cigarette, and after I took it, he said, "You're an American, aren't you?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I am."
And then what happened?
Then he pulled a sweater out of his pack and gave it to me and told me to put it on because I was going to catch cold otherwise. And then he said, "You know, I've always wanted to go to the United States. I understand it's a very beautiful country." And I said, "Yes, it is a very beautiful country."
You were finally released because your North Vietnamese captors found out about how you had rescued people who had been gunned down in the massacre at Takao at the North Vietnamese internment camp. Can you tell the story about how your captors found out about your actions there?
Well, all I knew at first was that they did find out. I hadn't told them about Takao because I didn't think they would be interested because the Vietnamese who were involved at Takao were all Anakamis, and so I didn't think the North Vietnamese would much care. That they did find that, though, after several weeks, and finally an officer came to me and said, "We have a tradition in Vietnam, but anyone who saves the life of one of our children is owed a blood debt." And he said, "We owe you a blood debt, and we're going to release you." And that's how it happened. I later found out how I did discover the truth of Takao. I had a Vietnamese reporter friend, a very close one in Saigon, who was the principal Vietnamese reporter for Time magazine. And I went back to Vietnam about 2 years ago and called on him in the middle of the night, and he came to the door, and he was wearing the uniform of a colonel in the North Vietnamese Army, and he holds Vietnam's equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And this was a man who was privy to everything that was going on in Saigon and lots of secrets, and all the while he was working for Time magazine. He was a senior agent of North Vietnamese intelligence.
Journalist Robert Sam Anson is my guest, and his new book is called War News, A Young Reporter in Indochina. When your captors released you, they wanted you to sit down and write a statement.
Yes.
On your release. What did you say, and then what did they want you to add afterwards?
Well, I originally wrote a statement for them expressing thanksgiving for the treatment they had given me, which by and large was very good and a lot better, I suspect, than a North Vietnamese journalist would have received at the hands of American troops, and expressing wishes for peace. And they were not happy with the statement at all, and composed a long statement of propaganda bombast, saying that I thought that Richard Nixon was a long-fanged war criminal, and I had witnessed with my own eyes the heroic struggle of the Vietnamese and Cambodian people against U.S. imperialism. And they wanted me to read that statement as a condition, basically, for my release. And I said to them, "Look, first of all, I don't believe it. And secondly, if I say something like this, people are going to know that I was being forced to. So I wouldn't say it." And we, I went back and redrafted a statement saying that I wished for peace for all the children of Indochina, and that I hoped that one day my children would be able to live in a world of peace. And that seemed to satisfy the Vietnamese.
Did you feel like you had to make concessions you didn't want to make in that final statement?
I wish I hadn't made any statement at all. I felt, after I did make the statement, cowardly and ashamed of myself for having done it. I wish I had been more heroic and resisted them more, and wished I hadn't wanted to go home to be with my family so much.
The whole time you were reporting from Indochina, you were married. You were 24 and then 25 years old. Your wife was, I think, 21, mm-hmm. 22. Your children were both under two. And they were mostly, your wife and children were most of the time in Singapore, I believe.
Yes, they were.
While you were reporting. And I sense a lot of regret in reading your book and how you treated them, how comfortable you were just going off and leaving them behind in a strange country.
Well, I think I was being incredibly irresponsible, charging around the Cambodian countryside and putting myself daily in harm's way. If I had been killed or captured, my children would have been left without a father, my wife without a husband, and it would have been very, very difficult for them. And I was so caught up in the story that I wasn't paying sufficient attention to them or to a lot of things. I was there's an intoxication about a big story, and a further intoxication when it involves violence. witnessing violence can almost be a narcotic, and it's one of the dirty little secrets that the press has about the war in Vietnam, is that there is a real turn-on in seeing someone pop up out of a hole and take a shot at you and miss.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because it seems to me that for liberals who oppose war, mm-hmm. there's no longer a romance of war, but there is still a romance about war reporting.
There is, yeah, and it took a long time for me to get over that romance. It is so seductive, because everyone is living till the ultimate limits at that point. And it's really, especially in Cambodia, which was so dangerous and deadly for the press, you really had the feeling that each day could be your last, though you didn't dwell on it so much. You just wanted to live life to the fullest, and the friendships were closer, and the wine tasted better, and you drove faster. Everything was just, all senses were heightened. You really felt alive in a way that you've never felt before or since.
You say you got over that. You got over that romance.
Hopefully,
when, how?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I got over it I certainly didn't want to see any more war in Asia, because I feel a special attachment for Asia, and I was no longer interested in covering violence after witnessing on television, actually, the Israeli bombing of Beirut in 1982, and I had been tempted to go over to the Middle East to cover the war, and I saw what was going on in that kind of violence, and I remember just saying aloud to the television, I just don't need to see this stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm. When you run into a young, energetic reporter who's maybe a little headstrong,
mm-hmm.
like you once were, do you feel an affection and affinity for them, or do you?
Well, one of those young, headstrong reporters is my son,
uh-huh.
who's 21 years old, and he was just with me in Thailand, and he read the book for the first time. And I was terrified of his reading the book, because I was worried that he was going to use it as a roadmap for his career of the next few years. And sure enough, not a week passed before he blundered into Laos. He crossed the Mekong illegally and was sent back by Laotian authorities. I mean, I am trepidatious about those sorts of things, but it's hard to, you know, and I've lectured him a million times, please don't follow and commit the mistakes that I made, but everybody has got to learn on their own, and there is a romance, especially when you're that age.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, he's a terrific reporter, and I only hope that he has more common sense than his father did.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about some of your experiences while covering Vietnam and Cambodia. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Robert Sam Anson's new book is called War News, A Young Reporter in Indochina. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be dancer, actor, and singer Gregory Hines. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. computer animator John Lasseter can bring anything to life. Coming up, he talks about his cartoon Tintoy. It's the first computer animation to win the Academy Award. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Memphis musician and producer Willie Mitchell, the man who discovered Al Green and revived Memphis soul music. And John Leonard reviews What Am I Doing Here? It's a posthumously released collection of essays by the late travel writer Bruce Chatwin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Colombia's Minister of Justice, Monica de Graeff, the target of death threats from drug cartel leaders, has denied reports that she plans to resign out of fear for her family's safety. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
The 32-year-old justice minister vowed to stay on the job, saying the law is under siege in Colombia and must be protected. De Graeff plans to return to Colombia next week after meetings with administration officials. She told reporters she was in Washington to ask for an additional $19 million to protect Colombian judges. Last week, the Bush administration put together a $65 million emergency military aid package to help Colombia track down drug traffickers. Another $5 million has been allocated for the Judicial Protection Program. But De Graeff said more funds are needed for armored cars and metal detectors. Colombian drug lords have threatened to kill 10 judges for every one Colombian extradited to the U.S. Today, FBI Director William Sessions said extradition could spur revenge attacks here in the U.S. as well. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
President Bush met today with top cabinet officials to discuss his new anti-drug policy and promised the United States will do all it can to help Colombia fight its drug wars. White House officials have said the president's anti-drug plan will cost about $8 billion. That's $2 billion more than current anti-drug programs. The president will outline his program for fighting drugs in a broadcast address to the country September 5th. A month of peace talks on Cambodia ends tomorrow in Paris. In spite of intense last-minute efforts to find agreement, the talks will apparently end in failure. Roger Morier in Paris has more on the story.
Began a month ago here in Paris, most people involved believed there was some chance, however slim, to achieve a peaceful settlement in Cambodia. Now, though, most people here believe the country will have to go through several months of near-total civil war before any peace is possible. The main stumbling block has been and continues to be the role to be played by the former rulers, the Khmer Rouge, in any future Cambodian government. The Khmer Rouge insist they must be part of any government. The current rulers in Phnom Penh say the brutal Khmer Rouge must never be allowed to run the country again. Western countries say the peace conference, when it ends tomorrow, will have accomplished something by at least identifying the areas of disagreement among all parties in Cambodia. But in Paris tonight, no one is predicting when or how a peace settlement might eventually come about. For National Public Radio, I'm Roger Maurier in Paris.
In Frankfurt, West Germany, two teenagers from Czechoslovakia have been sentenced to 2 years on probation for hijacking a jet from Hungary. No one was injured in the March hijacking. The teenagers said they took over the airplane because they wanted asylum in the West. The two will be transferred to a youth home and allowed to go to school. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Willie Mitchell is one of the few people in the world of soul music who's worn all the hats, from jazz musician to producer to engineer. Mitchell's been responsible for dozens of classic Memphis sound recordings. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward re-examines Mitchell's many-faceted career.
I'll admit it, it's taken me a long time to get to the point where I can appreciate Willie Mitchell. Of all the people who've revolutionized black popular music in this country, this jazz-loving trumpeter from Memphis eluded me for the longest time. But these days, I have to concede that I must not have heard enough of the records he produced. Go figure. Willie Mitchell was born in 1928 and moved to Memphis with his family when he was three. He must have started playing soon after that, because before he was out of high school, he was a veteran of two of the best bands in the city, Tough Greens and Al Jackson Seniors. He attended Rust College, studied composition, and played on B.B. King's first records, and then formed a 17-piece band of his own. After serving in the Army, he came back to Memphis, formed another band, and based himself at the hippest club in town, the Plantation Inn. Among the jazz notables who were members at one time or another were Phineas Newborn Jr., Charles Lloyd, Booker Little, and George Coleman. By the end of the 50s, Mitchell had also started a new career, producing records for a small label called Home of the Blues. None of the records were hits, but the pop music bug had bitten him. And when Joe Quohai asked him in 1961 if he'd like to make records with his band for the High label, Mitchell jumped at the chance. "2075" came out in 1964 and was his first big hit. Already you can hear a few Willie Mitchell trademarks, that drum sound for one thing. By now he was warming to the possibilities of what was becoming known as soul music, and when Don Roby approached him to produce a couple of Memphians for Roby's Duke and Backbeat labels, Willie Mitchell said yes.
When we first met, baby, you said it, me and you. But I found out later there was others too. But I didn't quit you, baby. I hung on like a vine. But when you say your love for me was all in my
Bobby Bland got three hit singles out of the sessions he did with Mitchell, and now Mitchell approached Joe Quohai about signing some singers to High Records, where Mitchell's band was still making instrumental hits. Trouble was, by 1968, the Memphis soul explosion was winding down, and Stax Records across town had signed most of the hot talent, including plenty who'd grooved to the Willie Mitchell band at the Plantation Inn. Still, there was this skinny girl from Arkansas, Ann Peebles. Part-Time Love was her fourth record for High, and its sales convinced Quohai that Mitchell was onto something. Was he ever? He was on tour in Midland, Texas that year, and as the band rehearsed with the singer who was opening the show, Mitchell heard something. He ran to the phone and called Quohai and told him he'd be bringing back a superb singer. The kid had already had a mild hit called Back Up Train, but was about to chuck it all. He was in debt and very discouraged. Mitchell said that if he'd come back to Memphis with him, he'd pay off his debts. The kid agreed, and that's how Al Green got to Memphis. The first thing Mitchell had him record was, of all things, I Want to Hold Your Hand, but it was a Temptations number that really did it for Green and Mitchell.
A single grain of sand, yeah. You see, I can make a ship sail on dry land, children, yeah. Unhappy am I with all the powers that I possess, yeah. Girl, you're the key to my happiness, and I can't get next to you, babe.
And this is what I didn't like about Willie Mitchell. After I'd gotten used to the majesty of the Stax version of the Memphis sound, here was this guy whose stuff sounded like it was recorded in a coat closet.
Spending my days
On the other hand, it could be striking in its weirdness.
I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Yeah, when the rain, do you remember?
And who could resist that Memphis beat, the lazy, swaying, relaxed rhythm that Mitchell got out of his famous house band? Today, I enjoy the work he did as he rebuilt Memphis soul music almost single-handedly in the 70s with Al Green, Syl Johnson, Ann Peebles, O.V. Wright, and others. I don't know how I could have missed it the first time around.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. A few years ago, animator John Lasseter exchanged his colored pencils and sheets of rough paper for a computer. Lasseter's film Tin Toy won the 1988 Academy Award for Best Animated Short Feature, the first time a computer-generated film won the Oscar. Tin Toy is currently part of two touring animation festivals. Lasseter got his start doing traditional animation at the Walt Disney Studios, but his growing interest in computer animation led him to a job at Lucasfilm. Now he's with Pixar, a computer graphics company owned by Steve Jobs. In his early computer animation work, Lasseter brought inanimate objects to life, a family of lamps in Luxo Jr. and a unicycle in Red's Dream. But in Tin Toy, he created a computer-animated baby. I wanted to know if animating a human was an especially difficult task.
In the computer, it is, because a computer has difficulty doing very organic shapes. The computer likes to do things, you know, that are very perfect. And the baby, of course, is very organic. Also, what's difficult about it is that, from the audience standpoint, they know what a human looks like. They know what a human moves like. And so, as an animator, trying to do something that becomes convincing for the audience, it's very difficult. The old animators at Disney used to always complain about being assigned animating the prince in whatever fairy tale they were working on. They'd rather do the talking rabbits and things like that, because no one knows what a talking rabbit moves like. So,
how close do you think you got with the baby?
We're kind of still a ways away. I think the story was that the baby was really like a baby monster, so we were able to...
Right, like the hulking baby.
Yeah, right. So we were able to make it kind of horrific-looking, you know, in a way. You know, as far as, like, trying to reproduce humans with computers... We're still a long ways away from it, and to be honest, I'm not sure if I, you know, that's the direction we should go. And we have a little slogan saying reality is just a convenient measure of complexity, you know, so that's a way that we can focus in on developing the proper tools.
Let me ask you a few really stupid questions, okay?
Oh, great.
Say you're doing the baby for Tin Toy. Do you draw the baby, or do you feed in a picture of a baby? What's the origination of the image?
All right. In the 3D computer animation that I do, there is no drawing except in the preliminary stages. What we do is there's three basic steps. There's a modeling stage where you create within the computer a model, a three-dimensional model of the baby. The next stage is animation where you take, and very much like moving a G.I. Joe around, you know, it's like you animate the rotations of the shoulder and elbows and so on. The third stage is a rendering stage. And That's a stage where you take every surface that you've modeled, and you have to indicate a color. You have to indicate how shiny it is, whether it's got a texture like a wood grain on it or not. And then you have light sources that you give. You say, okay, what color the light is, how bright the light is, how far does it drop off, and so on, and whether it's got shadows or not. And that is, and then you let the computer, once you've done all that, then you let the computer sort of go and compute the final image and create sort of, you know, the colored image with the shading and shadows.
Okay, another really stupid question. When you're indicating to the computer what color it is, you're putting in a little bit of that color, right? You're not typing in blue.
You know, no, I'm not typing in blue. I'm actually typing in values of red, green, and blue. Like a nice blue would be about, I'd say, like, out of between 1 and 100, it would be like 20, 10, and 80. That's a really nice blue that we use all the time.
So still, you're typing, basically. You don't have a paintbrush in your hand.
You're correct. Sometimes I do long. My background is in traditional drawing and painting and so on, and sometimes I really long for the feeling of a 6B pencil on a rough tooth paper. You know, there's that wonderful feeling you have. And so, needless to say, all my notes that I write now are with 6B pencils on very rough paper.
Well, since you've described what it's like to animate a human, let's talk about computer animation of an inanimate object and giving the inanimate object some human type of characteristics, lifelike characteristics. Your cartoon Luxo, let's look at that. It's about...
Luxo Jr.
It's about a parent and child lamp, two lamps.
Right.
And describe what a Luxo lamp looks like.
Luxo lamp is they're commonly known as like an architect's lamp. They're sort of the lamps that clamp onto the side of a desk and can bend way over. They got the springs and the long rods on them. And Luxo Jr. was actually started when I was trying to find something to model within the computer. I had a Luxo lamp on my desk, and so I just started modeling that. And then started this second stage, I was started animating it and giving it life. I love to give inanimate objects sort of a personality. See, with computer animation, I think there's a lot of people that get excited about computer animation purely for the fact that it's created with a computer. And what I wanted to do, my background is in traditional animation, I wanted to very much to make this something to where people didn't look at it because it's made with a computer, but because of the characters in the story.
I think the most obvious cliched way of bringing a lamp to life in a cartoon would be to give it a face so it could smile or frown, give it eyes so it could cry.
Sure.
Now, you brought these to life without doing that. They looked just like lamps. But what kinds of considerations came into play in giving the lamps charisma?
Charisma. Well, I studied a lot in school and through my career, like Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin in their sense of pantomime.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I guess when I create a character, I always think about the personality. I try to get that solid in my mind before I do any of the animation. So when the character starts to do something, I sort of imagine what this character, how it would do it. And especially when comparing two characters like a baby and a parent as the two lamps, you know, I just wanted to give it some pathos and that warm and fuzzy feeling, you know, after he pops the ball.
What can computer animation do that hand-drawn animation can't?
When I first started working with computer animation, I really felt like, you know, the best thing about computer animation is the most difficult thing to do with hand-drawn animation and vice versa. Now, what computer animation can do is it can create really three-dimensional objects and move around those, and they stay completely rigid. They can shade, shadow, you know, light things. They can give almost a realistic quality to objects that you then can animate. That is very difficult to do with hand animation, to create real, like, airbrush style shading on the characters that doesn't jitter over through the animation. The difficult thing to do with computer animation that's easy to do with hand-drawn animation is organic shapes and moving those shapes around. Most of the Disney characters are just these really wonderfully kind of squishy characters in a sense, and they move around. They have a sense of solidity to them, but they're real flexible. To try to do that with a computer, it's really quite difficult. The baby in Tintoy was our sort of first attempt at that character, and I see it as just a beginning. We have a long way to go in working with those types of characters with a computer.
Is there a big generation gap now forming between the older animators who are working with drawing animation and the younger animators who are going into computers?
Actually, no, I don't find that. There was before my work started appearing with computer animation, because I think a lot of people working with computer animation were the same people that were developing the tools, the programs, and it's kind of like, you know, all the paintings being done by the chemists who create the paint.
Yeah.
You know, and so once I started working with a medium, a lot of the old animators, namely two good friends of mine who are like my mentors, are Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson, two of the great Disney animators. They look at the work that I do and are very envious. Ollie told me, he goes, oh, I wish I was young again. This is really exciting. Seeing this is like, you know, one of the first new technical advances within animation in probably, you know, 40 years or so.
If you had your way, would you be making cartoons that would look so real you'd think they were a movie?
If I had my way,
yes.
I would create animation that had a quality that people would sit there and look at and go, is this real? You know, but obviously it wouldn't be real. I don't want to create animation that is just sort of reproducing, you know, old actors or reproducing reality in just an easy way. I want to get that sort of paradox within the audience where they're sitting there, how was this made? What, you know? Yet, that wasn't the focus of the film. The focus is the characters and the fact that they're moving the audience in some way or another.
Do you think regular animation will ever become obsolete?
Oh, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
See, the thing is with a computer, it's not replacing anything. It's a new tool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as though someone came up with a really cool new pencil. That's what I look at it. A computer is just a cool new pencil. And it can do things really well that other mediums in animation cannot. But it cannot replace everything. You know, and I really look at the future is in the combination of traditional animation with computer animation, with model animation, and so on. You know, that style of animation is very, as I think, you know, going to be very exciting in the future.
Animator John Lasseter. His Oscar-winning film Tin Toy is part of Expanded Entertainment's second animation celebration and the Festival of Animation. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Ira Glass tonight has a report from Chicago about people in that area who have been hit by lightning, several of them, and they're having some strange after effects. Also, a report from Rick McCourt on the scientific revelation about new galaxies being born in the universe. And this story, did Television Guide, TV Guide, publish a cover illustration showing Oprah Winfrey surrounded by money, her face on the illustration, and Anne Margaret's body? The answer to that is yes. Oprah Winfrey's head on Anne Margaret's body, and Margaret shown wearing a Bob Mackie gown from a photograph that was taken 6 years ago.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The late Bruce Chatwin wrote travel books like In Patagonia, anthropological musings like Songlines, and novels like On the Black Hill and Utz. Now there's a posthumous collection of Chatwin essays called What Am I Doing Here? Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Bruce Chatwin wrote in a brilliant hurry, as if after an education into archaeology and Sanskrit at the University of Edinburgh, he'd spent too much time in London as an art auctioneer, buying and selling Byzantine cameos and Egyptian green slate palettes of the pre-dynastic period. He was 32 before he hit the road to his various wonder worlds, and 37 before he published his first book. From Patagonia, Africa, Brazil, Wales, Eastern Europe, and Australia, he managed 5 of these books, More Than Travel, Stranger Than Fiction, before he died last January, at age 48, of a rare Chinese fungus in his bone marrow. What Am I Doing Here? A posthumous anthology of 35 stories and essays, wry, feisty, and technicolored, suggests that he had at least 4 more books in him even if he'd never moved another inch. Who knew, for instance, that he'd already been to the Soviet Union, where he had strong opinions on iconoclasm and the constructivists, or to Afghanistan before it was ruined by hippies and Russians, or to India where he looked for wolf boys and Indira Gandhi, or to Nepal with his wife, an obliging botanist. Stinking like shamans of rancid yak butter, they sought the mythical Yeti. Wherever, he met interesting people, some famous, like Diana Vreeland, Werner Herzog, and André Malraux, and a few extremely odd. There was the Chinese geomancer hired to approve the dragon lines, the underwater currents and magnetic life force fields of a brand new Hong Kong bank, and the Englishman investigating the activities of black African Nazis in the late 30s, who was so excited by the idea of black men in black shirts with red armbands and black swastikas. Stranger still are the friends he made, like Donald Evans, an American artist in Amsterdam, who painted postage stamps for kingdoms of his own invention, or the South African composer Kevin Vollens, who adapted Stockhausen, prehistoric insect sounds, Zulu guitar music, the chipping of stones and the shouts of children, for harpsichord and string quartet. And always, down the Volga, remembering Turgenev, up in Everest, reading Dante, on the Pampas, contemplating Stonehenge and the Temple of Heaven, St. Peter's in Red Square, Mecca and Versailles, Chatwin disdained cities. What appealed to him in song lines about Aborigines on a walkabout, singing the sand dunes and gum trees and totemic beasts into being with each footfall, is what appealed to him about the Peruvian Indians, who 2,000 years ago turned a desert into a gigantic etching plate of geometric forms, and why he was so sympathetic to the anarchic peoples, the icon smashers, the men of the fringe who bedeviled Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt, Magyars and Mongols who rode the restless steppes, and why he celebrated, quote, the nomad's contempt for the pyramid, and why he was happiest on the savannah, the leopard-spotted land. For whenever I went back to Africa, he says, and saw a camel caravan, a view of white tents, of a single blue turban far off in the heat haze, I knew that, no matter what the Persians said, paradise never was a garden, but a waste of white thorns. I hope he's happy now, wherever. But I'm bitter and bereft on behalf of the rest of us, his readers.
John Leonard reviewed What Am I Doing Here by Bruce Chatwin. Fresh Air production assistant Lisa Bruton is leaving her windowless edit booth to travel through Southeast Asia. Somehow we failed to convince her that meeting Fresh Air deadlines is adventurous enough. Working on the show won't be the same without her. Her tape editing has made me, our guests, and our reviewers all sound better than we really are. But it's not just Lisa's talent, intelligence, tirelessness, and conscientiousness we'll miss. We'll miss her jokes, her enthusiasm, and the pleasure of working with her. By the way, Lisa, Amy wants to know if you plan on writing a travel book when you get back so she can schedule you as a guest on the show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next time on Fresh Air, actor and tap dancer Gregory Hines tells us why he stuck with tap, even when some of his contemporaries dismissed it as tomming. Also, novelist Taghi Modaresi talks about his new novel, set in Iran after the fall of the Shah. I'm Terry Grossner. I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.